made it to a Thursday here on Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming in the second half of today's show, Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news in North Dakota, and we have a cinematic showdown ahead. We'll join our film aficionado Matt Olean as he unveils his top 10 favorite movies of all time. It's a lineup packed with unforgettable classics and maybe a few opinions sure to stir the popcorn pot. We begin Main Street today with a conversation that gets to the heart of what it means to live a good life, and we're doing that in our segment we call Philosophical Currents. It's our monthly discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's back with us. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he hosts the radio show Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life that airs right here on Prairie Public. Jack, great to see you again.
I'm always happy to be here.
Jack, this discussion that we're going to have today came out of me visiting with you about Linda Pauling's story that we aired about a month ago here on Main Street. And she's the person who created the Make-A-Wish movement. And she did so after unimaginable tragedy in her life when her young son, Chris, died way too early of leukemia. She then inspired what became a worldwide movement. And so it begs, I think, the question, even after something like that, or even without something like that, what makes life meaningful? And is meaning something we discover, like Linda did, something we create, or is it destiny?
One of the oldest questions that people ask is, what kind of person should I be? And inherent in that is the question, what kind of life should I live? For some people, there's a clear answer to that. They have a religious text that guides them. They have some sort of ethical shining star. But for other people, it's a matter of exploration and discovery. And so philosophers have had a wonderful time just going back and forth, trying to pull threads to see which path is the most fruitful. Is there one answer for everybody? Is there a right and wrong answer? Or is this really just a personal exploration? And whichever answer you come to really depends on where you see yourself at your time of life, what culture you find yourself in, where in history you are. There are so many variables that this question has consumed people for thousands of years.
So in philosophical terms, what does it mean to choose one's purpose? Is that choice real? Are we defined or even limited by circumstances and culture? People can say when they're five, I want to be president. Well, a lot of stuff happens after that. What does it mean to choose?
Well, we've already gone down a deep rabbit hole because there's a foundational question even at the below that, which is whether or not human beings have free will. So let me give you an example. When I was younger, one of the things I wanted to be was a great rock and roll star. And I wanted to be that in part because I'm the son of a musician, but I also was growing up in the United States of America in the 1970s and 80s, and there were rock and roll stars everywhere. But suppose I was an Amish kid. Suppose I grew up without technology in an isolated community. Would I fantasize about being a rock and roll star? Probably not. Both because I didn't see the rock and roll stars, but also because even if I knew they existed, it wouldn't be a legitimate possibility. And so the question of choice is bound both by how much agency we have as individuals and how much we can sort of see our own possibilities, but it's also about the messages that we get and the context that we find ourselves in, because culture defines for us what our options are. I can choose amongst those options, but if the culture tells me, as a woman, I'm never going to get to be a scientist, or as a slave, I'll never get to be a landowner, then the choices that I have are much more severely limited. So there's always this balancing between how free we are amongst the choices that we have and how those choices are described to us by the people around us.
Who decides if our life has purpose? Do I decide that for me? Do you decide that for me? Who decides whether we are leading a purposeful life.
So the way to understand this debate is to sort of compare a classical point of view with what's called existentialism. And I'll go back and forth between talking a little technical and not technical here. But we all know that in the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the religions that come out of Abraham, we are made in God's image. And if we're made in God's image, there's a blueprint for human beings. Philosophers will call it an essence. That God designed a plan for our life. God designed a meaning for the human experience. And our job is to discover it and pursue it. And in this instance, and here's a technical way of saying it, essence precedes existence. The blueprint, the plan, the design was around before we were born, and we just have to meet those expectations. But in the early 20th century, for a lot of different reasons, existentialists came along and said this is backwards, that it's not that essence precedes existence. It's not that the blueprint came before we were born, but rather existence precedes essence. We're born without a blueprint. We're born without a meaning. Some of the existentialists were atheists, but some were deeply religious. Yet they argued that the meaning that we have, the plan that we have, the goals that we choose, the design and that we have for ourselves, this develops over time. Because there is no blueprint, there is no plan, and we get to decide for ourselves. And this leads also to a whole other interesting conversation about ethical relativism. If there's a God and we know what God wants, then there's a right and wrong. And it's clear and it's obvious, but it also can't be challenged. It can't be undermined. If there is no God, or if we don't know what God's message is, then trying to figure out what's right and what's wrong is a lot harder. It doesn't necessarily mean there's no right or wrong, but it does mean that there's a lot more variation and a lot more uncertainty. And so part of what choosing the meaning in our life means is also choosing what we think is valuable, what we think is good, what we think is right, and what we think is bad, what we think is evil, what we think is should be avoided.
I think all of us have lived our lives in a way such that decision perhaps changed at some time during our lives. We thought we were going down one path, circumstances presented themselves, and we questioned whether we are living the purpose that we want to live, and we changed direction, so to speak. That must be normal or human behavior, Jack, from a philosophical perspective.
I became a profoundly different person the moment my daughter was born. There's a story that I tell, which I won't get into, but one of the things that I say is that when I saw her for the first time, I felt Earth shift on its axis, right? My meaning, my purpose, my sense of self changed radically, including just spending the rest of my life terrified, right? Being a parent, you're constantly terrified that bad things are going to happen to your kid. Your perspective changes and your relative importance changes. All of a sudden, your kid is the most important thing in your life. Some people feel that more acutely than others. Some people change more radically than others. It's a different experience. There are certainly moments in our lives where biology, where circumstance, where perspective changes who we are. It happens at puberty. It happens probably at menopause. It happens when we get our first job or something along those lines, right? But then there are also times when we discover things. When we discover truths, when we encounter a great work of art, when we hear ourselves in a song. And those kinds of changes are the response of opening up a part of our identity at, I don't know how to say it, that speaks to the infinite possibilities of what it means to be a human being. And to see the universal in our particular experience, one of the wonders of seeing a great work of art. I've been lucky enough to see the Sistine Chapel a couple times in Rome. And I'm not a particularly religious person, and certainly I'm not of the Christian tradition. So I was not prepared for the depth and power of the experience of seeing the Sistine Chapel and the roof of the Sistine Chapel and how I just lost myself in it. And that's one of the wonders of the creative spirit and the imagination in human beings, that we can communicate with someone else's creativity and someone else's assertion that they exist, which is a fancy philosophy way of saying, you know, they did this thing and they were there. And just that interaction can make us see ourselves and our purpose differently.
Jack, how do philosophers talk about purpose and happiness? I guess I could decide my purpose isn't the thing that would make me the most happy. Maybe that's true. I'm not sure. I haven't really thought about it.
The first thing is to distinguish happiness from pleasure. So lots of people think being happy is that moment when they're lying in the sun or getting a massage, or for some people, high on heroin, right? There's lots of different kinds of pleasure. And from Aristotle on, people have really been insistent that we have to distinguish between the two in some important ways. Because let's talk about having a kid, for example. Let's say you are a new mother and your baby is 3 weeks old and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're breastfeeding the baby and you're exhausted. You haven't had any sleep. Your body hasn't recovered from the trauma of birth. Your breasts are sore and tender. You have no idea what's going on. You're confused because you're a new mother. And yet you're sitting there with the baby at your breast, and lots of mothers will describe that as the happiest they've ever been in their entire lives. And if happiness is just pleasure, that makes no sense. Athletes who are training really hard or winning at a race that is taking every ounce of their strength will often describe that as a kind of happiness, but it's not pleasure. And what the idea of a purpose does is it gives meaning in addition to just feeling. It gives us a story that we tell. It gives us a place in the universe. It gives us a way to decide what to do next. And so lots of people, and Aristotle is one of them, but the existentialists are too, will argue that purpose is essential for happiness because fulfilling your purpose is part of the criteria for knowing whether you're happy or not, for knowing that you're doing the right thing. And we may be wrong about our purpose, or we may change what our purpose is. You can't say that a watch is doing a good job unless you know what a watch is for. You can't say that a racehorse is an excellent racehorse unless you know what the racehorse is supposed to do. It's very hard to say that you are an excellent person or even a happy person if you don't know what it means to be a person and what a person is supposed to do.
We're enjoying our monthly conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We call the segment Philosophical Currents. Jack's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, where does passion fit into our purpose?
This is a particularly modern point of view. For much of human history and for many, many cultures, the idea of passion was foreign, if not completely unintelligible. People had a role, people had a job, people fulfilled a function, people were citizens or parents or soldiers or other things. And what they wanted and what they cared about was tertiary at best. But from the 18th century on, once we invented the idea of individuality, which is a whole other conversation, once we started to figure out what it meant to be an individual person, we started to value the self-respect that people develop and the sense of purpose that individuals have and the sense that people have to, and this is abstract, but consent to their own lives. They have to choose for themselves what they do. And passion is one of the ways that in our very, very modern understanding of what it means to be a person, we identify that the person chooses their own life, that the person values what they do. If you are stuck in a cubicle working 40 hours a week for a job that you regard as unimportant, for a boss that you don't like, for a salary that you think is unjustifiably low compared to what the owners make, not only do you lack passion, but you feel like you're being denied something important. You feel like life isn't fair. You feel like you're not giving or getting what you deserve to give or get. Passion is one of those things that allows us to escape that trap. If you can leave that cubicle and spend the weekend hiking in a mountain or practicing the cello or taking care of people you love or insert activity there, and that's what's going to be important to you. That's where your priorities are going to lie. And when you have passion, you can also adjust your other behaviors. If you have a passion to hike a mountain, then you also will have a passion to be fit, to eat a certain kind of food, to spend your money on hiking boots or day packs or things like that. If you have a passion for painting or hockey, then you are going to purchase brushes or hockey sticks. You're going to, again, wake up at a certain time or to sleep at a certain time or have friendships that cultivate those activities. What passion allows you to do is give you the will, to give you the dedication and the discipline to focus on the things that you see are as important and that give you a sense of satisfaction and purpose.
We've talked about isolation several times over the course of our discussions, Jack, and I'm wondering, where does community play into understanding and meaning? And simply, can we find meaning in isolation?
This too is one of the fault lines in the history of philosophy. It's generally regarded that human beings are social animals, that we're pack animals. We need other people. And we need other people not just because other people are important, but because it's hard to see ourselves without seeing ourselves in other people, right? Let's just take a silly example. You know, I'm tall, right? I wouldn't know what tall meant if I didn't have other people around me. If all of my friends were NBA players, I would be short, right? I would have a very different sense of myself. What we consider good, what we consider valuable, what we consider satisfying is very much a part of what we see in our community and also our sense of self-worth. One of the great tragedies is there are lots of people who will go years without being physically touched, without being hugged or have their hand held. Now, there are people in the world who don't want to be touched, and that's fine. But as a general rule, human beings like to hug. Human beings like to snuggle. Human beings like to feel someone else's hands on them or even just be noticed by them, be seen by them, be heard by them. Without this touch, without this connectivity, without this interaction with other people, we become isolated and depressed and stuck in our own heads. I mean, you've had this experience. I'm sure all of our listeners have had this experience where you've spent the day alone and you've been mulling over some idea or some slight or insult or something, and you're just getting angrier and angrier and crazier and crazier. And then something happens and you talk to people and you decide you discover you were completely wrong, or this thing never happened, or you were angry about nothing.
Wasn't a big deal at all.
Or right? It wasn't a big deal at all. Or it was a big deal, but you've just gotten over it, right?
Could be. Mm-hmm.
We get stuck in our heads, and we can get stuck in our heads for 20 minutes. We can get stuck in our heads for 6 hours. We can get stuck in our heads for 5 years. There's a whole culture now of young men who get stuck in their heads. They're called incels. And what they are young men who live on the internet who end up hating women because they resent the fact that they feel ignored and put down by women. And then all of their other friends are online voices or text messages and other incels who feel the same way. And they just get deeper and deeper in their anger and their unhappiness, and they blame other people. We need community, and we need other people. And we need other people for meaning, for love, for affirmation, but also for people who experience other things and fail so we don't have to, right? Learn from our elders, learn from the person who rode the bike and didn't wear a helmet and then was in the hospital for 6 months, right? We are a pack animal, and we're never going to be fully who we are unless we're in a community that regards us as an equal, important, integrated part of that community.
We have so much more distraction and noise in our lives today, I think, than we had maybe 30 years ago. Perhaps I'm wrong about that. Perhaps I just care more or hear more about certain things. But it seems to me, with technology in particular, we have more distraction and noise. And it makes me wonder then, is it harder for us to find meaning when we have many different issues bombarding us that we are worrying about, that we maybe wouldn't have even thought about 30 years ago when all this noise wouldn't have been coming our way?
I am sure that that's the case, although it might be 50 or 60 years ago. But, you know, the World Wide Web started in 1994. So that's 31 years ago. I mentioned in passing a heroin addict earlier, and how a heroin addict may confuse the high of heroin as a pleasure or happiness. Well, one of the things that science is discovering and that we are all experiencing is that we are all, in some sense, addicted to our electronics, that social networks, that waiting for likes, that seeing the latest TikTok, it increases our dopamine, it affects our serotonin, it raises our cortisol levels, which cause us to be anxious and our bodies to be inflamed, which then leads to heart disease and high blood pressure and all sorts of other things. We are literally addicted to our electronics. And because we are addicted to our electronics, we are constantly looking at a world which is full of anger, full of hostility, full of, even at the best, something like Instagram, where people are showing off all of the wonderful things that they're doing. Most Instagram viewers don't look at a post of someone hiking on a mountain and think, oh, I'll go hike on a mountain. They think that person has it so much better than me because they get to hike on mountains and I don't get to do that. And their life is perfect and my life is terrible and I'm going to be depressed. And all of that is psychological, but at the heart of it is also neurological. It is legitimately causing changes in our brain structure and our physiology. And it is very, very hard to find peace, to find contentment, to enjoy silence. You know, you remember when we were younger, you were meeting someone somewhere and they were late. What did you do? You sat at the table or you stood in the corner and you stared. You thought, you watched people as they walked by, you noticed the pigeons, you did all these things because our toleration for boredom was really our ability to use our imagination. People don't do that anymore. No. People look at their phone immediately. And people don't know how to be bored anymore. People don't know how to exhale. And there are people who are trying to counter this, talking about meditation and mindfulness and all of these other ideas. And then there are people who will turn off their phones for certain periods of time. But as a culture, as a people, and I think most of the people in the world who have access to phones, it is incredibly hard to find peace and contentment. And that means it's incredibly hard to find a purpose. And if it's incredibly hard to find a purpose, it's really hard to meditate on the meaning of your life and why you're here.
Okay, Jack, let's wrap it up with that. And you are not a psychiatrist, you are a philosopher. But for those people who are maybe unsure about their purpose, what's a good philosophical starting point?
Oh, that's a hard question, because what I would actually suggest, rather than pick up a philosophy book, is find a piece of creativity you love, whether it's a book, whether it's a piece of music, whether it's a painting, and think about why you love it. And use that experience to ask yourself what you find is important. And then talk to some people about why you think those things are important. And that process of finding beauty and creativity in the world and then finding community will help you figure out what you want to think about next, what you want to learn about next. And then maybe there's some philosophy I can suggest, or then maybe there are some other things. But reading a philosophical treatise about the purpose of life is going to help very few people.
I like your suggestions, Jack. We visit with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein monthly on Prairie Public's Main Street right here. It's called Philosophical Currents, and it's always a great pleasure to visit with you, Jack. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota. Thanks.
This was excellent and challenging. I really enjoyed it. Like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He
always got a gift for me. Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Public's news director Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news. And let's roll out the red carpet. Matt Olien reveals his ultimate top 10 films. It's a master list of movie magic with a twist or two that'll spark debate among cinephiles. That's ahead on Main Street. Stay with us. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's my pleasure to welcome Dave Thompson back to the Main Street studio. Dave, of course, is our longtime news director here at Prairie Public. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Craig. How about you?
I'm doing well. You spent some time in Western North Dakota.
Certainly did.
A nickel and copper minerals processing facility has been announced there. This is the big deal, Dave.
You know, there's been a lot of talk for at least a few years about the idea of minerals who are used for computers, things like that. One of the main suppliers is China, and the U.S. kind of wants to get away from China. So they've been doing some research into the taconite mine in Minnesota and also into coal in North Dakota, and they find these rare earth minerals in these deposits. So now the taconite mine is ready to go forward with a project to get these minerals out of the taconite. And it's a great location. Talking to the people who are putting it, this Talon Metals, they said they settled on Beulah because, A, there was an abandoned coal mine there, because the Beulah mine is being shut down and being reclaimed, but they can use some of the coal tailings from that. B, you have great transportation. BNSF runs from the taconite mine to Beulah. And C, you got a lot of power, because that's where power is being produced. So they think it's a win-win-win for everybody. So that's going to start very soon. Actually, the city's been working on it for a few years now, and finally things have come together. The building is going to start in 2027. And Craig, when it's built, it's going to have 150, you know, permanent full-time jobs, which is good for a city like Beulah. Plus, you've got all the construction jobs coming in, too. So it's going to be a nice economic boon for that part of the state.
Dave, some good news of sorts. It's still not great news, but 2024 crash numbers are out and fatalities are the lowest they've been in 24 years.
I know that is not the best of news because there are still fatalities, but it is a good news from where we're at. And it looks like this year is going to be about the same if the pace continues like it is. A couple of things that they're saying what happened, we've got a mandatory, you know, got seatbelt law, which is now primary enforcement. It used to be just secondary enforcement. And then, you know, I think drivers are more cognizant about being safer on the roadways. Then, of course, the legislature passes a bill for 80 miles per hour speed limit. The DOT doesn't think that's going to be much of a problem, but they say that we need to do some more work in getting people to buckle up, which it's amazing that there are people who are driving around not buckled up.
Yeah, that is amazing to me as well, especially cars kind of encourage you, I should say, to buckle up, you know, with their beeps and stuff until you do. And let's hope that everyone buckles up when they're traveling the roadways here in North Dakota this summer.
Absolutely. Now, there's hand in hand with the higher speed limits. They've raised the fine for speeding in construction zones. It used to be $80. Effective August 1st, it'll be $150. That might also help with safety.
Dave, there's been a pipeline spill, and I've never heard of this. 3 million gallons of brine.
That's correct.
Spilled. This isn't the brine we use to cook our Thanksgiving turkey, Dave.
No, we're talking about brine that's used in recovery oil. You know, it's used the whole oil recovery process. And this stuff is, you know, it's a little bit toxic. Not as bad as oil, of course. Oil spills would be a lot harder to clear up. But this one is going to take some time because of the size of the spill, and you're talking about 3 million gallons, which is one of the biggest spills of brine or this produced oil, or produced water, I should say, in the state history.
And this spill was in Williams County, Dave, correct?
That is correct. It has affected a creek, and that's another concern.
We reviewed the news again with my good friend and our longtime news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, have a good weekend.
You too, Craig. Gather around everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story
about a little fella. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
There's our fanfare we look forward to each and every Thursday. My good friend Matt Olean stops by the Main Street studio again. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Greg. Good to talk to you.
We're going to continue your review of the top movies of all time. Last week, we talked about movies number 20 through 11. So now, film lovers, buckle up. This time, we're going to roll out the red carpet for Matt's top 10 movies of all time. And Matt, before we get into that, when was the last time this list changed?
Oh, a couple of years ago, I switched some things around a little bit. Dropped some things, moved some things up, that kind of thing.
Well, let's get to movie number 10. It's one we've all heard about, Matt. I wonder how many of us have really seen it.
Well, I think a lot of people have seen Casablanca. Yeah. I would hope so by this time. It's the film with more good lines than any other movie in history, right? Every 20, 30 seconds, there's a good line coming out of these actors' mouths. And my question is, what were those writers eating for breakfast? I mean, it's just, and there's lines that we all know today, you know, round up the usual suspects, things like that. Just a great film, and a film that was not supposed to be a great film. It was kind of a Warner Brothers film that I don't think they had a lot of hopes for, but it became this big thing. And over the years, it became a cult film on television late night. And it's got maybe the best last line of any movie as Bogart and Claude Rains walk off into the fog. You know, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And it really is an interesting film, too, because it gave Americans kind of what was at stake in World War II. And Bogart eventually can't sit it out. He doesn't want to be involved, but in the end, he does the right thing.
Number 9, Death in Venice.
Yeah, 1971, Luchino Visconti, Italian filmmaker. This is maybe the big art house film of all time. It's not a lot of dialogue in this movie. Dirk Bogart is the star. It's ostensibly based on the composer Gustav Mahler. And of course, Mahler's music is much in the film. Not an easy sit for a lot of people because there's not a lot of dialogue, but it's a beautiful film. Captivated me when I first saw it kind of in my post-college years, and certainly one that a lot of my friends have not seen. So I love it, though.
Number 8, The Deer Hunter, a drama that follows, wasn't it three close friends from Pennsylvania, Matt? Yeah.
It's a mining town. Robert De Niro, Chris Walken wins the supporting actor Oscar. A film I saw when I was 14, right when it won the Best Picture Oscar. My dad and I went to the movie, and at that time, it was probably the best film I think I'd ever seen. But I was still a year away from seeing a couple films that are coming up in the list. But kind of a life-changing experience watching this movie, just so intense. Michael Cimino, who never, ever got close to equaling this success. His next film was Heaven's Gate, the disastrous film that, you know, ruined his career, basically. But it's a leisurely paced film. You know, that first hour or so, as you remember, Craig, is the wedding sequence. I mean, they're, you know, one of the friends gets married. They go off to Vietnam. There's not a Vietnam scene until about an hour and 20 minutes into this movie. But the Russian roulette scenes are intense. People never forget those scenes. Some controversy over those scenes, whether that stuff really happened in POW camps or not. There was some pushback against the film at the time. But a gripping film. And just you feel the – I've driven through those steel towns in Pennsylvania, Craig, and shooting it right where they did in a Pennsylvania steel town, you feel kind of the dirt and the grime of that city and its effect on people. Maybe Robert De Niro's best underrated performance, too, as the lead character in the film.
All right, let's move up your list, Matt, of the top 10 movies of all time. Now we are at number 7.
The Third Man from 1950. This is a film that is on Turner Classic a lot. Joseph Cotten, Orson Welles, Trevor Howard, kind of Vienna after World War II. The film was, you know, the city was partitioned between the British and the Americans and the Russians. And it's kind of an espionage thriller, Carol Reed, the British director, has these kind of odd angles he shoots the film in. It feels like a Hitchcock film, except it's not a Hitchcock film. Some great lines in the movie, some the great last shot that everyone, not everyone, but people who've seen it kind of know what I'm talking about. Orson Welles' appearance late in the film is this amazing cameo he has. Just a wonderful film.
Let's continue moving up. Number six.
If, 1968, directed by Lindsay Anderson, a British film director. I always say this is the best film that almost no one's ever seen. It's the film that made Malcolm McDowell a star right before Clockwork Orange came out. And it's about a British boys' school at the time, late 60s, rebellion going on. And it's really a film ahead of its time. I'm not going to reveal too much about the ending, but the ending is shocking and almost foretelling of what would happen at schools in future years, basically in America. But just a crazy film to watch, beautiful to watch. The film goes back and forth between color and black and white. And as Lindsay Anderson said at the time, the film is kind of like the writing on the wall. And I would say that's a very accurate depiction of that movie. And the title, If, is based on the Kipling poem, If.
Matt, we've talked about this before, but a movie like this, could I find it on a streaming service tonight?
Boy, If is a hard one to find. I caught it home from college one time. My brother had an early dish in Oaks, North Dakota, and I don't know how I saw it, but I when I started watching it, I realized this is the film that my film book had been talking about, this Leslie Hollywell film book that I got in high school that really was a masterful book about this British film critic named Leslie Hollywell, who kind of went through films and reviewed them and whatnot, and then I saw it. I saw the whole thing again and was just captivated by it. I'm not sure how to find that movie. It's IF... That's the name of the film.
We're visiting with Matt Olean. Of course, he reviews movies every week. We're going through the top 10 movies. His 10th movie was Casablanca. Number 9 was Death in Venice. Number 8, The Deer Hunter. Number 7, The Third Man. Number 6, If, 1968. Now, Matt, we are into your top 5. What is your 5th? Best show of all time in your mind?
Bonnie and Clyde, 1967. This is a film that certainly changed the face of American cinema. That last scene, Craig, that everyone is kind of familiar with, no one had ever seen a scene like that in theaters up until that time. The slow motion death scene, you know, the bullets, the blood. But it's almost like a ballet. You know, you almost feel sorry for Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway at the end because Arthur Penn, the director, has manipulated the audience into seeing them as kind of like anti-heroes. You know, the banks are the villains. And just the way the film is shot, kind of that Flatt and Scruggs music in the background, you know, as they're getting chased by the cops. And, you know, it really portrays the criminals as really heroes. And I think that was the twist they pulled off in the late 60s. When it was first released, right away, it was not a hit, but eventually it became a hit. People saw it on television. And as I said, that last scene is a scene that was groundbreaking.
We advance now to number 4. Who can forget Peter O'Toole, for those of you who have seen Lawrence of Arabia, Matt?
Saw this in the theater last year on a re-release. It is a dream of a film. Steven Spielberg once called it that, a dream of a film. In fact, he saw it in high school, Craig, and he said, when I saw the film, I wanted to be a filmmaker. And then he said, I went back a second time, and I didn't want to be a filmmaker because David Lean, the director, had set the bar too high. Like Spielberg thought, no one can make a movie like this. If this movie was shot today, Craig, the desert would be CGI'd in. This was filmed in the desert, in Morocco, in Jordan. Peter O'Toole's performance, he's really touched by something, don't you think, Craig? I mean, sometimes I think in acting or art, there's something different that's touching someone. His performance is just insane. It's so good. And that's what he was associated with the rest of his career. But the desert looks great. Maybe the most beautiful film ever shot, and it would look totally different today if it was made today.
Your next film, Matt, is a classic. And this is a film, and looking back, I can't understand why our parents took us, but we saw this at the drive-in, Matt, when I was 10 years old. And of course, it's The Godfather.
You saw it when you were 10. I had to wait till I was like 14. Wow, that's quite a memory, Craig.
I think they banked that I was going to go to sleep here before things started,
awake when the horse head came?
I remember that well.
So this is, I read the book first. Yeah, my mom let me read the book. I had to kind of wait a little bit to see the movie on TV. And we're talking about part one, 1972. You know, it's better than the book. They took on a lot of salacious stuff from Mario Puzo's book, but, you know, famously, Francis Coppola, the director, had a hard time casting this movie. Paramount wanted nothing to do with Marlon Brando as Don Corleone. They did not want Al Pacino, then an unknown, as Michael. You know, they wanted other people. Well, Coppola was right. And from the opening scene, if you remember, Craig, this man in this dark room, and the camera zooms out from him. He's telling about his daughter being raped and beaten, and the men who did this got a suspended sentence. And then at the end, he says, "For justice, we must go to Don Corleone." And of course, the camera pulls out, and it's Marlon Brando as this mafia don. And you're locked in. And that first 30 minutes is all the wedding scene. And you kind of learn the exposition of all the characters you're supposed to know going through this. Amazing performances by Brando and Pacino, but the supporting performances, James Caan, Robert Duvall, it's perfectly cast. It's like a snake pit. You're just into it immediately. And, you know, I've run into a lot of people that see this movie for the first time and they don't move for 3 hours. They don't move. They're transfixed. The ending scene is amazing. You know, Michael eventually becomes the head of the family, becomes even a worse killer than his father. And it sets the tone for part two, of course, which came 2 years later.
Your second top movie of all time, Matt, is?
Citizen Kane. Now, Skip Wood, who used to work here as our producer, called it the most overrated movie of all time. I don't think so. I've seen this movie at least 5 or 6 times. Its reputation precedes it. A lot of people think it's the best film ever made. I think a couple things that are interesting about this movie, it looks different than any other movie made in 1941, right, Craig? I mean, the ceiling shots, the way the camera, the Greg Toland cinematography, and also the amazing screenplay by Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. It's flashbacks within flashbacks. The timing of the film, the time structure is so strange. As this famous man dies, the reporter tries to find out what Rosebud means, and he interviews all these people who have memories of Kane, but they all have different flashbacks of him, and the timeline jumps around, but you're able to follow it. And so the screenplay was revolutionary as well at the time. So amazing movie. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but for cinephiles like myself, there's so many tricks and treats to watch every time you see it.
But there's one movie, Matt, that you thought was better, and rarely do sequels live up to their originals. What's your top, your most favorite movie of all time?
I think it's The Godfather Part Two. It enlarges the scope of Part One in that Part Two, you get the flashbacks to Vito coming from Sicily. You know, Robert De Niro plays the Brando character, plus it's Michael in the late 50s and, you know, Lake Tahoe and Cuba and Las Vegas and all these things. And so it really becomes, I think, an epic vision of the corruption of the American dream. That's what that movie is. It's not only the best film I've ever seen, it's the best film ever made about America. You know, you've got the immigrant story, the corruption of the American dream. You know, Michael's fate is sealed once he shoots the cop in Part One. He's going to be the head of the family. There's so many great scenes in this movie. You know, down in Havana where Michael gives Fredo the kiss on the lips, the kiss of death. You broke my heart, Fredo. There's a scene near the end of the film where Robert Duvall visits Michael V. Gazzo in prison, and Gazzo plays Frankie Five Angels. That is such a great scene. A lot of people who are listening will know what I'm talking about. Just a monumental film. It's beautiful to watch. You know, the ending is heartbreaking as Michael looks back on his life, and just an amazing film. I, you know, sometimes I think I'll never see another film that good in my life, and it kind of depresses me. Maybe I won't, but maybe that's the best film I'll ever see or ever will see.
Time will tell. The next one could be around the corner, Matt. Of course,
you never know.
We'll be here with you as new films come out. You've got a blockbuster to review next week. We'll tease that a little bit.
Yeah, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. It hit big at the box office over the Memorial Day weekend. And not only are we going to review that, Craig, I'm going to pose the question that I posed
on
Facebook. Is Tom Cruise the greatest male film star of all time? And I am very serious with this question. We've got a sample size of over 40 years now of his movies, and we'll talk about it.
I am looking forward to that. Let's go toward the Oscar trivia part of our segment, Matt. Which of the following films in your top 10 list did not win the Academy Award for Best Picture? Here's your subset of those films to pick from: The Godfather Part II, The Deer Hunter, Casablanca, and Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane famously did not win Best Picture. It only won one Oscar that night for Best Screenplay.
That's correct, and that was your second favorite movie. All right, Matt, let's bounce down a little farther here. Okay. Citizen Kane was nominated for Best Picture. Bonnie and Clyde did not win. It was also nominated for Best Picture. Which of your top 10 movies were not nominated, Matt, for Best Picture?
So If, The Third Man, and Death in Venice were not nominated for Best Picture.
Uncanny, Matt. We've been to the movies, all of Matt's best movies, with our movie reviewer, Matt O'Lee. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
You bet.
Hey, it's A. Martinez, part of the team that wakes you up to the news of the nation and the world every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News. Now, another member of the team behind your morning routine is Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. He keeps you wise to all the goings-on in Bismarck, as well as the important and fascinating stories making headlines in North Dakota, from energy and agriculture to flood control and tribal news. All this news gathering and reporting from places far and wide takes the help of a committed group of listeners who contribute to this station. If you're not already one of them, you can join today by donating at prairiepublic.org, and thanks.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by A Taste of Ireland, a live music and dance production featuring international Irish dance champions, coming to Grand Forks June 8th. Information at atasteofirelandshow.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 29th. On this date in 1895, Red Thunder was in jail awaiting trial. Though no one had been killed, sensational reports of a so-called Turtle Mountain War stirred fear. Canadian troops mobilized along the border, but the U.S. declined to send forces, saying the Chippewa had legal rights in the area and the situation was exaggerated. The conflict began when Native people were threatened with arrest for cutting timber near St. John. Believing troops were coming, a group of mixed heritage Natives stole four guns from a hardware store and fortified themselves behind cordwood. Surrounded by a sheriff's posse, they asked to negotiate with federal officials. Red Thunder persuaded them to surrender peacefully, but was arrested himself. A missionary priest who knew him well denied the dramatic reports, describing Red Thunder as doubled over with age and afflicted with pleurisy. But the Bismarck Tribune claimed Red Thunder made a desperate resistance. It took three men to handcuff him. He is 88 years old, but almost crazy with maniacal strength. The Griggs Courier noted, excited by the blood-curdling stories, Red Thunder has excited unusual interest and has been seen by almost everybody, including the children. One child, expecting a large, imposing giant, was disappointed. Despite national headlines painting him as violent, the sheriff described Red Thunder as a model prisoner, refusing outdoor exercise unless as a free man. He was released when it seemed he might die in custody. One paper acknowledged his actual role. His office is that of orator for a band of Chippewas. Red Thunder is remembered for his wisdom, tenacity, and compassion. An annual powwow and drum group are named in his honor. His 1892 speech during the McCumber 10-cent treaty was cited by tribal historian Pat Gorno. When you, the white man, first put your foot upon this land, you found no one but the red man and the Indian woman. These are the children and descendants of that woman. They must be recognized as members of this tribe. In 2019, that quote was unveiled at the International Peace Garden, honoring Native contributions to the region. Red Thunder was the first to represent the Native voice there, alongside global leaders. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. that kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
And by Martin Media, bringing Paula Poundstone, comic and regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to the Fargo Theater on Friday, May 30th. Tickets and information at paulapoundstone.com.
And that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Thank you very much for joining us today. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central in this time slot, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. He'll ask the question, is a college education still worth the cost? And at 7 p.m., it's Science Friday with Ira Plato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a wonderful North Dakota weekend, and we will see you back here Monday on Main Street.